And we are live a little over 10 minutes late, and it has to do with an issue with my my computer that I use for streaming and some issues it's having with games in the past. I have all of a sudden, how ironic was that? I disappeared, but not for the reason I was talking about. That was just a bullshit internet interruption. Anyway, what I was saying is there's been a few streams where I've just kind of disappeared. And then maybe a minute or two later, I come back, and that has to do with the USB port on the computer that I use for streaming. I was trying to rectify that. It wasn't doable, but I have a backup solution in place because we're all about redundancy around here that should prevent that. But it can't prevent what just happened, which I think was just the universe going, I got a joke for you. Anyway, what are we talking about today? We're going to talk about a joke. Monetary creation in the modern system of economics in the economy of the United States and basically every government and central bank of the world right now. It's all been the same. Even the ones that say the U.S. sucks, they're predatory, like the central banks of every country follow the model we're going to talk about today. And it's already started the ideology with my shitcoin's better than your shitcoin, and we need privacy in the shitcoin space, and the Bitcoin isn't privacy, so it's shit, whatever. Like, here's the thing today. This show today has nothing to do with Bitcoin. It has nothing to do with crypto. We're not even going to talk about it other than to address it because it came up in the chat while I was getting ready to go live. Might it be one of many solutions to the problems that we're going to talk about today? Sure, but we're not talking about that today. We're actually going to explain money, right? What is money? And when I say money, I do mean the money that is used most in our country today, the United States dollar. It's not real money. It's money. You'll understand that it might be flawed money, but flawed money is still money. By the time we're done today, I'm going to talk to you today about things like, where's it come from? Where does money come from? How do we actually create money? How are they born? How do they die? If something can be born, dollars are born and put into circulation, it can also die. Got it? Die. People are asking about the new office. I've decided not to do the work myself, and we're waiting for the tax return to come to pay for the work that I'm going to have somebody else do. That's why the new office isn't here yet. I just decided I have better things to do at my time than do that work. Anyway, we're going to talk about where they come from, dollars, how they create children and grandchildren, and how eventually they die through quantitative tightening or monetary contraction, something people don't seem to realize. We don't always inflate. Sometimes for brief periods of time, we actually deflate the M3 monetary supply. You'll know what the M3 monetary supply is at the end of this. We're going to talk about money, how it derives worth, inflation, deflation, and something really important that gets so missed when we talk about inflation, and that is monetary velocity. Just printing more money itself doesn't create the inflation that many of you believe it does. The money has to move and multiply through the economy to have that effect. We'll talk about, again, how paying off debt actually eliminates money. I'm going to explain it to you with a Star Trek analogy. Maybe it'll make sense. We're going to talk about why the income tax even exists. You think it's so we can have roads and schools? No, it's not. It doesn't pay for that. It doesn't pay for any of that. It actually exists to service the debt. That's the only thing it does. And I'm going to prove it to you because the first time I actually did this show, 2009, that's why I said it's not about Bitcoin, because I go way back with Bitcoin, way, way, way back. I don't go quite that far. I wasn't a believer in 09 when it was just recently created, okay? This show is basically a rerun in a way, except I'm doing it now 16 years later. That's how it's differentiated, or 17 years later, something like that. And I'm going to give you some facts at the end of today's episode that were true in 2009 of the 2009 budgetary year. And then I'm going to give you the same facts stated in 2025 dollars, which is the most recent stuff we can have as to knowing like how much was paid in, how much was the interest, how much was the new debt. And the similarities between today and 2009 will absolutely shock you if you've never been through this exercise before. So that is what we're going to talk about. But the first thing we're going to do today is we are going to say thank you to our sponsors of the day. And sponsor of the day number one today is certainly someplace that you can turn to learn more about how to mitigate a lot of what we're going to talk about today. Investing your money is one way to mitigate inflation. In fact, I believe that some of the inflation is designed to force investing decisions on people who would rather simply be savers. But if you want to know how to invest your money, you should listen to John Pugliano, independent money manager who made himself a liquid millionaire before he touched a single dime of a client's money. He's also a prepper. He's one of us. He is a ham radio operator. He's got the store of food. He plants the garden. He is part of this community. I've been working with John since 2010. That's 16 years back, all the way back to when I did the first episode of this show that we're going to be doing today about monetary creation and where money comes from and understanding money. John definitely understands money, and he does a weekly podcast at wealthsteading.com where you can learn to grow your wealth like you grow a garden. And the beauty of this podcast is he's telling you exactly what he's doing with his money and his clients' money at any given time. Next up today, I said today's show is not about crypto. It's also not about precious metals. However, there is a solution to a lot of the problems we're going to talk about today, and that is to invest in hard, long-term, durable assets. One of those options is precious metals. That includes silver and gold, and you should definitely make it part of your wealth assurance plan. I personally hold about 5% of my net wealth in silver and gold. That's the recommendation I've given forever, and I've said I'm fine with people going up to 10% of their net wealth. I think anything more than that, you're a little bit overloaded, but you make your own decisions. The easy decision, though, is where do you get your precious metals from? It's all the same. That's the point. So all you need is somebody you can trust. At that point, you should be buying from the people with the best service, the best terms, and the best price. That is JM Bullion. They support this show and have done so since 2013. So they've been around here a little while. I can get directly to the president if necessary. They have better pricing than Monex and Atmex and Lear Capital. They have a great reputation with our audience. All your orders will ship free. Why would you get your precious metal from anyone else? Unless, I guess, if you were buying local, I would understand that. But if you're ordering online, JM Bullion is a place that I can absolutely recommend to you over and over. So with that in mind, let's go ahead and start kind of digging into today's topic. And I just want to start out with, again, this is not some backwards way to get you to learn about Bitcoin today. This is straight up a lesson in how money works in our modern system. It is also an objective lesson. I may throw some opinion in at time, but that will be clear and obvious when I do it. Okay. Mostly, I'm just telling you the way things are, how they work, and then showing you proof points to demonstrate that I'm not pulling it out of my ass. So let's start off with how money is created today. So what is always said, especially on talk radio and social media and what have you, is they just print money. They just print money. They just print money. This is the most short-sighted, absent-minded, lazy ass bullshit explanation of what's going on you can come up with. And I understand why. Effectively, it's sort of kind of true, except it's not printing anything. There is no money printer go burr because they're not printing it. When you say print, you think of bills like that you can hold. Less than 3% of the total monetary supply of money in United States dollars exists in printed form. So clearly it doesn't just mean they printed it. It doesn't mean they conjured it out of what looks like nothing, though. And the way it works, it's actually very simple. And it's also, your mind is going to repel it because it sounds so preposterous that, and it's so easy to understand in how preposterous it is, that your mind repels it. Because if this is true, then it just jacks with everything that you've come to believe in society. But this is how it works. I'm going to start with when they say the government is printing money, what that actually means. So we do not have any sort of true reserve for our currency. We don't have gold or Bitcoin or real estate or the net value of all the forest products in the country. We have no anchor at all other than who will loan us money. Okay. And so what the government does is it creates a, well, yeah, the government creates a bond. And then when people buy the bond, effectively the government is borrowing money. Okay. And at that point, we haven't actually really created more money, but we sort of have. But I want to skip over that. But there does come points at time where the government needs more money than people are willing to lend it at any given moment. And that's where we talk about the Federal Reserve becoming the lender of last resort. And when that happens, the government issues the bond and the Federal Reserve makes journal entry. It just says, deposit to the, you know, government, federal government of the United States, the United States Treasury, $1 billion or $10 billion or $100 billion. It doesn't matter. Whatever it is, they make a journal entry. There's no actual money that changes hands. The Federal Reserve doesn't have the money. They buy the bond with a journal entry and nothing else. That is now real money. It has been created out of thin air. That's what they mean when they say the government is printing money. I'm oversimplifying it a little bit, but that's enough for you to understand what's going on. And then our system is called fractional reserve. So what you need to understand is it is not only the government that prints money. That's your monetary base. That's your monetary base. So the money goes into circulation one way or another. It ends up in the banks through interbank lending or from the discount Fed rate to the banks. It ends up in the banks because the government spends it. Somebody else gets it. Somebody else spends it. It gets deposited in a bank. One way or another, most money, not all money, but most money in the United States spends most of its time in somebody's banking system. They're either in Wells Fargo or Chase or whoever. It doesn't matter. Okay. Now, the banks create children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, and so on with that money. And they do so by lending you money. Let's say a very simple thing to understand, a house. You go to buy a house. You find an entry-level house for about $200,000 if you can still do that. You come up with a down payment and some closing costs. And then the bank loans you. Let's say the loan itself was a $200,000 loan. So it's $215,000, $220,000 is the price of the house, and you borrow $200,000. Most people are under the belief that the bank says, we have money, so let's give, you know, Aaron, who is here, Aaron Sweet, let's give her $200,000 of money that she can use to buy the house, and that money goes to the seller and then pays off the balance of the seller's mortgage. And that seems very rational. It seems to make sense. If you went to your uncle who was wealthy and he gave you a loan for $200,000 at, let's say, 7% interest over 10 years or something, then he would have to take his money and give it to you. He would have to first have it. That is not what banks do. The bank takes your promise to repay plus the real estate as collateral and a down payment from you as a leverage point, and then they make a journal entry that says, deposit $200,000 to Aaron Sweet with conditions, right? Because Aaron can't just now run off with that $200,000 and go to say Wataneo. Aaron, that loan they gave you was specifically to buy that house. So you actually hold the money for a fraction of a moment on closing day, and they'll finally send it over, and then it passes through. And what Aaron actually gets is a mortgage payment. And the seller gets the $200,000 or $220,000 or whatever it is, less what they owe their lending bank that gave them a mortgage, and they get that as real money. If let's say they own the house outright, to make this even more clear, there's $200,000, $220,000, whatever it is now, in their hands. They can go spend it. It can do things, but it came from nowhere. It came from Aaron's promise and to repay based on her credit rating and her future income potential. That's where it came from. It was conjured out of thin air. This is not a conspiracy theory. If you look up, if you go to Google and you search for Modern Money Mechanics PDF, you'll find a publication from one of the Federal Reserve banks that explains what I explained to you exactly as I explained it. And it even says, if not, no new money would have been created. So every time you borrow money, and this is not just houses, a credit card, line of credit, right, that you get with your MasterCard, when you have $2,000 on that credit card that you now owe, let's say, Chase Bank, that $2,000 was created the same way. They issued you a line of credit in the form of a credit card, right, instead of a revolving line of credit like a business might have, and said you could spend up to this much money with these payment terms, you know, 21% interest compounded every 5 seconds or whatever it is, right? And every dollar that you spend that way, everything that goes onto your balance is created by the act of lending something that does that they don't have. And again, if your brain is like, how can you lend what you don't have? They simply made the rules that they follow and said they can. That's it. That's the entire system that you live under. Basically, you're buying nothing with nothing and creating something with nothing. And if you're like, you know, the laws of like physics and even quantum physics and shit say this can't happen, you're correct. But it's you're trying to look for a rational reality within an irrational system that was designed to benefit the people that created it, not you. So it is a system of debt slavery that creates money through the act of convincing slaves to go into debt with you. That doesn't mean I won't use that system. That doesn't mean I don't have a mortgage, but I know what I'm touching when I touch it. You know what the word mortgage means? Death grip. Mortality. Gauge, Old English, to grip. Mortal grip. To be under the grip of death. That's what a mortgage is. Couldn't make that shit up if I tried, right? Now let's talk about how money derives worth. And somebody here is saying defund Israel. And that has what to do with what we're talking about today, my special friend? I mean, seriously, I don't even necessarily disagree with you, but no, it wouldn't solve your problem. And if you think it would solve your problem, you don't understand the problem. Ideologues have no place in objective discussions, because what happens is that ideology replaces rational thought. I'm done. People like this, shut them up for a little while. Anyway, because you're a distraction, but you can try again in 5 minutes and see if you piss me off again. Anyway, yeah, I don't dispute that we send everybody too much money and way too much to Israel. Israel's a very wealthy country. They should pay for their own shit. But that's not why this is a problem. Israel could vanish from the map. This would still be a problem. They're a rounding error in the national budget. And see, this is where, again, you can't keep jamming your ideological bullshit into objective analysis and end up with an objective analysis that's useful to you in life. Because how would that solve your problem? If we just got rid of foreign aid to Israel, the problem would be solved. No, it wouldn't. The bank would still invent money out of nothing when they gave you a loan for a mortgage on your house, you simpleton. I'm sorry, but it's true. It doesn't matter. This thing is bad. So what? It doesn't fix the problem if you get rid of that one bad thing. Your house burned down because you threw gas on it and lit a match. And your argument is, if we didn't extract oil, it wouldn't have happened. And that is more connected than what you just tried to connect, because at least that's where the gas came from. But if you really wanted your house to burn down, you would have found another accelerant. Anyway, so money derives its worth because people accept it and use it, and it draws its value from the economy it circulates in based on economic laws and both a combination of rational and irrational market responses. And what I mean by that is, if everybody decided tomorrow, I don't care what policy anybody tried to counter it with, if every person, or even the simple vast majority, let's say like a 70% majority, tomorrow decided the United States dollar is now worthless in their mind, nothing changed, just their mind, and they then said, I will not accept it as payment any longer for anything. I will keep my stuff, and you will have to bring something to me. And if you bring something to me that I value enough, I'll exchange it with you. That might be gold. That might be barter. It might be Bitcoin. It might be a shitcoin. It might be a completely new currency. But the day that people made that conscious choice, the money itself would fail. And every form of money that has ever failed has gone through that process as part of its failure. When the confidence was lost, the money no longer had value. So the number one thing is the agreement to use something as money. There are intrinsic characteristics that make something good money. Gold would be an example: durable, indestructible, hard to inflate. It's you know, an ounce is an ounce is an ounce, so it's all the same. It's divisible, right? It has other flaws in a modern monetary system where we want to move things at the speed of light, but it does form a good anchor in that even though we can always find more gold, every time you increase the supply, the amount you need to inflate, let's say over 3% the next year goes up with it. You're chasing it as you go. So unlike a system that we have now where the government or the Federal Reserve Central Bank can just decide, hey, we're going to inflate by 10% of supply, you can't do it with gold. It's a much more effective anchor. But it still requires people to agree, I'm going to use this currency based on gold, or I'm going to use hard gold itself as currency. If people don't agree, it becomes worthless as money. It becomes from an agreement. And then we have to look at the things that are inside of all of this, which are inflation, deflation, and monetary velocity. Now, yeah, kind of like a shrubbery. You probably had like an economics 101 class in high school. And they probably taught you about inflation a hell of a lot more than deflation. Other than they told you deflation's bad, which actually doesn't make any sense under critical analysis. But the definition that they gave you of inflation is probably when you make more money, all the other money is worth less. So if we only had $1,000 in existence in the whole economy, whatever that would be, and I add $500 to it, I effectively devalued the existing money by a third. The new money has got to get its value relative to the economy from somewhere, and the only place to take it is the existing supply. This is half the half of the cause of modern inflation. Another thing they probably told you about, and this is part of what's called velocity of money, is something called supply and demand. So it is not inflation if there is so much demand for a product that manufacturing cannot keep up with the demand, because all the other stuff might be, let's say, inflating at 1.5% this year. Now, I know it's higher than that, but just hear me out. So in general, your cost of living is inflating at 1.5-2%. And then you have this item that you really, because you really want, you focus on it, and it goes up in cost by 50%. And you say it's inflation. It might be, but it probably isn't. If you don't have a corresponding match with many things in the economy, and it's isolated to one thing or one class of thing, then what has happened is the demand for that has gone. That's a supply-demand curve. Okay? Now, the supply and demand curve has an indirect effect on what's called monetary velocity, because if there's enough supply and demand mismatch that you start having shortages of goods, that can create a situation where people might borrow more money to cover the cost because the desire is that high. Still, it's inconsequential to the whole. In general, monetary velocity is when that lending step, that second-tier lending, the banks lending to buy homes, the banks lending small business loans, the banks lending for people to buy cars. When that happens at a high scale, the money moves faster. And when it moves, then its effects are felt. Trying to put it in a way that, like, because I know there's resistance to this idea, because every time I talk about it, people resist it. I could print $1 trillion tomorrow through the Federal Reserve Central Bank system, regardless of how I do it. I could print $1 trillion if I put it into the economy somehow, and when it goes into the economy, it doesn't do anything. It will have no net inflation effect. if there was a bunch of debt and I used it to erase the debt, I would actually contract the monetary supply. We'll get to how in a bit. And if anything, there would be a net negative effect even by creating more money, because the money that was created specifically to destroy money. Right? It is only when the money moves and multiplies, when the housing market is actually heating up, in the words of HGTV, with every real estate show they show you, because it's always heating up apparently, according to these people. But when it actually is, when people are buying cars, when car sales are high, when housing sales are high, when credit card usage is high, then you're going to have a more marked effect on inflation. This is why the Federal Reserve sees raising interest rates as a way to rein in inflation. Instead of directly contracting the monetary supply, they slow down monetary velocity by making the cost of credit higher. That kind of explains the whole thing for you. Now, what is deflation? Deflation is when the cost of things go down. And you can have niche-specific deflation that's more a supply-demand plus efficiency curve, or you can have actual deflation. Actual deflation would be your cost of living just goes down, right? All of a sudden, you go to the grocery store, and it just costs 10% less, and it stays that way for a while. When you go to the car, the car lot, and you look to buy a new car, it's not, I'm making a deal today, right? It's, hey, here's, look at the sticker prices. They're lower. That would be true deflation. If it was across many classes of goods, that would be true economic deflation. Where we see specific examples of deflation that are driven by efficiency are in technology, in places where manufacturing truly can hit economy of scale and drive down costs. And it shows you that the natural state of our economic system actually should be slightly deflationary over time. Prices should not go up in a well-run, well-ordered, and highly educated society. Prices should slowly decline across time. And, I mean, even in a place like manufacturing, when Henry Ford started building the Model T, his goal was to build more cars and charge less for them every year. And that worked for quite a while, actually. I really recommend reading My Life and Work by Henry Ford to learn more about that. But if you look at true deflation, I just saw an advertisement. I think it was $268 or $270 or $249, but it was under $300 for a 65-inch flat-screen TV. I think it was Walmart selling it. 65 inches. This is, if you were to go back 20 years and buy a 50-inch flat-screen, you're talking thousands of dollars. And it didn't have the technology built into it that these modern ones do. And if you look across the board in the realm of technology, everything's less than it used to be. Because it's a natural state in a well-run economy where economy of scale and efficiency takes over and competition drives prices down. Yeah, if I'm the only guy making something and I make $1,000 a unit on them, then I'm going to keep doing that as long as I can sell all that I can make. However, if competitors jump in and all of a sudden they're cutting me down by $500 and they're willing to take a $500 profit, I got to compete with them. And then it's a race as close to the bottom as we can get. And you only have two things you can do when you're providing a service or a product like that. Maximize the efficiency more. In other words, drive down your cost, right? Or increase sales. And that's how everything should work. We should have a deflationary economy. It's not the big danger that all the people that benefit from the system we have tell you it is. Because what they'll say is, well, if that happened, then people would, you know, just hoard money and nobody would spend anything and innovation would stop. And what's the most innovative market we have? Technology. Are you going to not buy a TV because it's cheaper? And that's what they'll say, well, because it will be cheaper tomorrow. But it always is cheaper tomorrow and people still buy them today. Because you want what you want when you want it and you have a certain amount of money you're willing to part with to get it. It's a nonsensical thing. This person here says, my Samsung 32-inch in 2005 was $1,500. I completely believe that. What did a Commodore 64 cost in 1984? Go look it up if you want to. But then for fun, do inflation-adjusted calculation and say, if we were using 2026 money – in 1984 to buy a Commodore 64 computer, what would it have cost? And it's thousands of dollars. And right now you can buy a brand new PC with Windows, whatever the hell they use now on it, $500, which is about the cost of a Commodore 64 in 1984 dollars in 1984. You can buy a badass machine for $1,500 that, like, the differential between anything you could have bought in the 80s and there is, you can't even talk about it. It's so big. So why do we get better, faster, and more for less in tech and not really anywhere else? And the reality is, it's because it's the one place where the inertia of advancement is so extreme as to overcome the anchoring system of a fractional reserve monetary system. That's why. Okay. So how does money then disappear? I said, when you pay off debt, it disappears. When you pay off debt, it literally eliminates money. And when you default on debt and eventually the person that's expecting to get paid someday writes it off as a loss, that also eliminates money. And that's how you can end up with a shrinking M3 monetary supply. So I want to tell you right now, before we go on with this part, what the M3 is, if you've never heard of it. It's actually, you have to look for it to find it now. It's not openly reported, though we can figure it out, and there's plenty of sources that do. But the M3 is all the dollars in existence, down to the change in your couch that you can't find. So I'm not going to go through M1 and M2, but M3 is everything. Deposits, outstanding, pocket change, dollars, checking accounts, bank accounts, money market funds, all, every dollar in existence is the M3. And if you look at the M3, as you might imagine, it's a continuous growth curve. But there are parts and times where it has these little bitty dips that, as big as the growth has been in the last, you know, decade, it's hard to see them. Except right at the end of COVID, there's a pretty big dip. It doesn't go anywhere near back to like mean of where that standard line should be, but it did come down quite a bit. And it's because of how this works. And I want to give you an analogy that may be really helpful in understanding this. Because, again, your brain goes, I don't understand how me paying you back makes money go, the supply go down. And if I loan you $100 out of my wallet, a C note, I give it to you. And a month later, you come and give me $100 back and say, thanks for the loan. It doesn't reduce the monetary supply at all, because actual money changed hands. We're going to use spooky technology, the Star Trek transporter. So there's a very famous episode of Star Trek where there was a transporter error, and the character known as Will Riker was basically beamed up off a planet, but a reflection created a copy of him. And at that moment in time, there were two Will Rikers. One eventually decided to go by his middle name of Thomas. So William Thomas Riker became William Riker and Thomas Riker. Thomas Riker ended up in a jail on the planet for like a 10-year period. And Will, of course, advanced to becoming the first officer of the flagship of the Federation, the Enterprise. And eventually, though, there's two Wills standing there looking at each other. They have both now had 10 years of life. One's still a lieutenant. One's a commander. You know, one was a prisoner. One was chasing his dreams. And then they continue on. Obviously, this is fantasy. But what if, let's modify the story, that when it was found that there were two, we said, this is wrong. And you reverse the process and put them back to one. And so you merge the two into a single. What if when that initial transporter mishap had happened, it was identified swiftly and the transporter technician had done the merge immediately? There would have been a brief period of time with two and back to one. Okay. Now think about what I said about how lending money from the bank works on a house. You say, I want to buy a house. Okay. They create the $200,000 out of thin air and give it to you. And somewhere, somehow, it ends up in the economy circulating. On their books, they have as accounts receivable $200,000 plus interest over 30 years. That's money. That also can be leveraged and used, because they can actually use it to create even more money, because they can say we have this as an income. So now the money exists that never existed, both in a promise, okay, and in a receivable. As it's paid back, it's like putting the two characters back together. And eventually, when the debt is fully repaid, all the money that was being held as debt is gone. And the money to pay it back had to come from a new loan from somewhere else to create more money, because there's always more money owed than money that exists. And the money that's due back is due back plus interest. If your brain hurts right now, again, it is not because this is actually hard to understand. It's easy to understand, but it doesn't make logical or rational sense unless you are of a belief that credit is money. And a system of credits is a system of money, which is exactly what it is. I didn't say it was good money, but it is a system of money. Anybody says, it's not real money, it's worthless, then give me all of yours. Then give me all of yours. You won't? Why not? It's worthless, right? If I said, hey, outside in your yard is a garbage bag full of shit you're going to throw away anyway, give me that. You'd be like, here, I don't care, because it's worthless to you. So why won't you give me money that you call worthless? What you actually are saying is, it's what we have, it's what we have to deal with, I don't like it, but yeah, it's money. And you're saying it regardless of what you speak in your actions. When you're willing to go to a place and work for an asshole like me who says, you shall do these things every day, 8 hours a day in that seat or outside with a shovel or whatever it is, and I will tender to you this journal entry in the form of a paycheck, and you do that, you're acknowledging it as money. When you turn around and write a check to your landlord if you're a renter, or your bank if you're a homeowner, you are then propagating that money back through and using it as money. So you can't come back and say it's not real money. You can come back and say it's a poor form of money, but the one that the powers of be have hoisted on us that we're forced to deal with. That's an objective, rational response to what you don't like. It's worthless is nonsense. And you ever notice all the people that are on TV with that message selling you like gold and silver, even though I believe in gold and silver, like the dollar is worthless, put your money in gold. What are they selling you the gold for? So you'll be their best friend, or are you giving them the dollar that tells you is useless? Right. The dollar is a energy storage battery like all forms of money. And this is a theory called thermoeconomics. And basically what I'm saying is, by doing work, by putting out energy, I'm able to earn value in the form of money that is a battery I can use to hold it until I need to buy something else with it. And that's why people that live paycheck to paycheck actually feel less pain from inflation than people who save money. That seems counterintuitive, but it's true. Because if you're earning money this week and spending it next week, inflation has almost no impact. Now, long term, you have to keep earning more to keep pace. But most people actually somewhat do, or they wouldn't be able to survive. But that money doesn't devalue itself, okay, fast enough to harm your ability to purchase with it. But if you were an old school saver and you converted all the money you didn't spend to cash on the barrel, put it in a box hidden under your mattress, then if you had 5% inflation, real inflation over a year, and you had $100,000 in there, it is no different than if the money had remained stable, I broke in and stole $5,000 out of the box. You now have $95,000 of effective spending capability. And if that 5% repeats itself multiple times, it is going to have the value of your money in about 7.5 to 8 years. Scary, isn't it? That's the system that you live in. Now, the traps in this, the total debt is always bigger than the total supply. In other words, when any politician talks about paying off the debt, they're making a promise that not only is a lie, because that's just typical of a politician, they're making a promise that cannot be fulfilled. Under the current system, you would have to alter the system of monetary creation and monetary anchoring to be able to pay off the debt fully. And notice I didn't even say it would be a bad thing economically to pay off the debt. And on our current system, paying it all off would be, because it's also impossible. And we would contract the monetary supply to almost zero, by the way. That's how that works. You'd be shocked if you look at the M3 relative to how much it can do per annum. In other words, $1 doesn't do $1 worth of work per year. It changes hands many times. If you calculate that and look at the M3 and figure out how that multiplies as it moves through the system, the M3 and the debt outstanding will come to almost an exact balancing, because that's how it's designed to work. So the trap is it can never be repaid. If all money is created through lending and all lending comes with interest, and the only way to get more money is to lend it with more interest, then you can never balance the books. It is mathematically impossible to do without changing the underlying core system of monetary creation and banking in our current situation. It cannot be done. Anybody that says it is a liar or willfully ignorant or just not smart enough to understand it. They're, you know, peak on the Dunning-Kruger curve. They believe they understand it, but they don't. And when I tell people that the income tax exists to service the debt, not for primary spending, they always kind of like, that sounds crazy. Well, everything I told you sounds crazy. And it's also true. But let me explain it in a way that'll make perfect sense. The first time I went through this bullet point list and did this show was back in 2000. It was actually 2010, because using 2009's numbers. But it was based on 2009's numbers. Just like it's 2026, we're not done yet with the year. So I have to get the most recent figures I can from the Treasury to do this. So I'm going to give you the 2009 numbers. Then I'm going to give you the 2025 numbers. As you might imagine, there's a lot of growth, but I want you to look at the delta that we're going to end up with. So in 2009, new federal debt means all the money the government took in and borrowed to create new money by borrowing it was $1.1 trillion. Okay, $1.1 trillion. Yes, 2009. The expense of the interest alone at that time in 2009 was $383 billion. So we had $1.1 trillion of new debt and $383 billion of interest against it added. The total personal income tax receipts in 2009, I'm talking about individual income tax here, were $1.21 trillion. Some of you can do math in your head and you're going, oh, I see where this is going. Okay, we spent $1.48 trillion to service debt in 2009, roughly $200 billion more than income tax receipts. And at that number, $200 billion is like saying 20,000 when you're talking about a million. Okay, it's almost inconsequential in the delta. It's very close. But in the end, all the income tax you paid, all the tax paid at a personal level, not corporate taxes, did not sufficiently fund the debt. It almost did. Okay? Now, you ready to be wowed? Like David fucking Copperfield making the Statue of Liberty disappear wowed? Watch me bring the same pattern into 2025, 15 years later. Okay, or 16 years later. New federal debt in 2025, $1.8 trillion. Got it? $1.8 trillion. The expense of interest alone in 2025, that should scare you, $970 billion. So I said back when I did this show, within about 15 years, we would have $1 trillion expense in just interest. You can go back and listen to it if you want to, because I really said that shit. We're off by what, $30 billion? Pretty close, huh? $970 billion last year in interest. Personal income tax receipts in 2025, $2.7 trillion. That's how much you, me, and everybody else paid in personal income tax. That's not Social Security, not corporate tax. It's not property tax. It's not the gas. Personal income tax, $2.7 trillion. We spent $2.77 trillion to service the debt in 2025, new debt plus interest, about $70 billion more than income tax receipts. once again, we're just a little short in our personal income tax of covering interest plus borrowing on the national debt. Okay? 16 years apart, the pattern is almost identical. If you go back to 1972, which is the first year we were fully under this standard after the 71 closing of the gold window by Nixon. And so 72 was the first fiscal year that the entire year was under that new system. And you check every year from 1972 to 2025, you will find that we are very close to this same result in about 95% of years. That is so consistent as to be designed. That does not happen by accident. There should be much more variation than that if we were not in a system that simply views the individual taxpayer as a means to fund the debt that they buy everything they want with, the debt that they fund their own salaries with, the debt that they pay their lackeys with, the debt that they use to offer contracts to their brother-in-law and their uncle's former cousin's roommate. Right? They generate all this money through lending, and they use you as the servicer of the debt. Your tax dollars do not buy a new highway. They do not pay for a new bridge, not when we're talking about your income taxes. They don't build a school for you, and they don't put a football field on it. Okay? They don't run a jobs program for your company to take part in. All the shit they claim, it doesn't pay for your local police department. It doesn't pay for your state police. It does pay for the FBI, the CIA, and the military, sort of, but it becomes debt first. Without servicing that debt, there is no point to it. Basically, we're paying for everything that we have with all the other taxes, plus the new debt, which you finance through your labor. In other words, you are a cow on a ranch with a brand, and you are leveraged as debt cattle. They are able to borrow based on only the fact that they can extort money from you in the form of taxation. Now, you might notice I didn't give you a lot of solutions today. I told you this was not a show about Bitcoin, and I meant it. I told you this was a show that was not about crypto, and I meant it. I told you this show today, this episode, was not about even gold and silver, even though we talked about it a little bit, and I meant it. What I want you to understand here is simply where money comes from, how it's manipulated. Basically, I'm giving you, in the words of Safe Dean Amos, right, the fiat standard explanation today. And you have to understand why we got here, because it seems so ridiculous. Why did we end up in this place? Well, if you go back, let's go back to prior to 1913, before there was a Federal Reserve. We were on a true gold standard, and that meant that when times got crunched, there was only so much money that could be loaned. It kind of would seize up the economy, but it was when there were problems, market conditions would rapidly fix them. There was no such thing. You can't hoard money forever. So eventually, you got to do something with money, or what's the point of having it? So when things would tighten up, eventually then the economy would slow down, and then there wouldn't be things, and then people would have to pay more for them, and the money would begin to flow, and the economy would rectify itself, because the economy is a lot more like a biological organism than we are taught to believe. We are taught to believe that some central planner can control it all with one computer and one screen, and it just doesn't work that way. There's a lot of dynamic elements. So those dynamic elements began to come under the control of the central planner to a large degree with that first formation. But there was still a gold anchor. But what a lot of people don't know is it wasn't one for one even back then. Even though the bank would say, oh, pay to the bearer on demand. If you came in with a $20 bill, I will give you a $20 gold coin. It didn't mean that there was a balance. It was already about 40% reserve based on the way banks handle lending. In other words, they anchored the monetary base, but we still had a fractional reserve system. Most people don't know that. They think, oh, everything was just per. No. No. And the Federal Reserve was able to use this to manipulate the economy even before Roosevelt seized the gold. when Roosevelt seized the gold, they revalued it, instant inflation. Almost doubled it overnight, almost double inflation overnight, but it took time to percolate through because we were in the middle of the Great Depression and monetary velocity was low. So that didn't do anything right away. And then we went into a wartime footing and things like that. By the time we got to this point in the world, though, you know, we're wiring money all over the world. London is the financial capital of the world, but the British banking system took it up the butt really hard with World War One. A lot of lying and shenanigans that were ahead of ours went on. I don't want to go into all of it, but that was going on. So the U.S. starts to become like the economic center of the world. And we're now living in a society where we need to be able to settle payments, not just across borders, but oceans, thousands of miles. We need electronic money. And that need was real, but it was also used to justify peeling further away from gold. Through the 60s, 50s and 60s, honestly, that whole tether was just being stretched with lies. The actual amount of gold in reserve did not only not equal the amount of money in circulation, the delta was bigger than we were admitting. The French under Charles de Gaulle began to call our bullshit on it, and every settlement that they obtained in dollars, they turned around to the United States and went, we want the gold. By the time Nixon in 1971 said, I am temporarily suspending the gold standard, which, again, nothing is so permanent as a temporary government policy, Nixon didn't do what people think he did. Nixon would be equivalent to a doctor takes terrible care of a patient for 2 weeks at the hospital, barely keeping him alive, but making mistake after mistake after mistake in how they treat the patient. Nixon is the doctor that when that shitty doctor, and I'm not defending Nixon, I'm just in the situation, right? That new doctor could be shitty too, right? But he's not the one that killed the patient. So the shitty doctor, the first shitty doctor goes on vacation, goes off to play golf, you know, at Myrtle Beach or whatever. And so a new doctor takes over and he walks in and looks at the charts and goes, holy shit, this guy's going to die. And a couple of weeks later, the guy flatlines and that doctor says, time of death, 7:02 a.m. And everybody says, that's the doctor that did it. No, the doctor that did the bad job is those 20 years, the 50s and 60s, of stretching that tether beyond reality. Nixon inherited a situation, economically anyway, where it was the only thing left to do. And it was the plan all along, in my opinion. So at that point, we just said the dollar and gold are not related. And we hid the reality for about another 4 years, because it wasn't until 1975 that we could truly see the results of these decades of lies. Because what happened in 1975? You and me and everybody like us could once again in the United States own gold. There became, for the first time since the 30s, a true independent market for gold as a reserve form of currency. And meaning that I could buy it, you could buy it, somebody could spin up an ETF for it. They didn't have ETFs yet back then, but there were types of funds that would hold gold within them. But you could go to a place and buy a gold bar and bring it home and stick it in a box. So people actually had to compete for the available gold, and the decoupling just accelerated like mad. To where there's ways you could have done better with your money from 1975, let's say 2025, that 50 years. But had you put, like, if you had been a fairly wealthy person to put all your money in gold in 1975, checked out by now, and your heirs were inheriting it today, they would have done fairly well with that play. If you took all the money you had in 1975, no matter how much it was, let's say it was $200,000. $200,000 in 1975 was a significant amount of money. I mean, it was wealth. $200,000 today is nothing to sneeze at, but you're not going to retire because you found out, you know, you're 40 and your uncle had a $200,000 box of $200,000 in $100 bills, and all of a sudden it's handed to you. We found it. You're the last heir on the chain. Here you go. You'd be like, great. Are you going to quit your job? No, I'm not. 40? I can't live for the rest of my life on this. you would have been at least, depending on how your other finances were in 1975, you'd have been at least thinking about it. Because you could have continued to build your wealth while drawing down the right value ratio against your total holdings. You know, 3% a year or something like that. You could make more than 3%. You could continue to grow. So the 3% you could borrow next year or pull out next year would have been higher than this year. You could have kept pace with inflation with that amount of money properly leveraged. Yeah. You couldn't make that happen with the same amount of money today, right? Because inflation ate it. That's how we ended up where we are. So my question is, what are you going to do about it? We're going to have a second part to this show. When it was originally done, I did it as two parts. So next week, I'll do a part two of it. And some of the solutions will be in there. But we're also going to talk about a lot of other things that we kind of ended with today when we get there. But I'll tell you that the only solution that you have is investing in assets and holding assets long term. Buy property that's expensive and scarce and hold it a long time. This has been the formula for wealth of the rich forever. And a piece of it that most people will never understand and always see as risky is rich people do this by never selling their assets. The only time they do sell an asset is where there is a specific opportunity to exchange asset A for asset B, and asset B is a higher quality asset. In other words, but what would I do with the money if I sold it? You can see that more in a microcosm right now down at the individual level, coming from a different school of thought, but the same general conclusion. In other words, people would say to me right now, Jack, what'd you pay for your house? About 200. What do you think it's worth today? 550? Maybe 6? In the current market? Yeah, I mean, I know I 500, boom. And what do you owe on it? I won't tell you, but a lot less than the 205 I paid for it. Well, man, you could get a big check and go buy a different house. But what would I buy? If I'm buying something from an investment-only standpoint, maybe I could do something that produces more cash flow for me. But if it's a place to live, what I'm actually going to end up with, based on interest rates and total expenses today, is less house that costs me as much or more money, and I have to move. Why would I do that? And I wouldn't. Okay. Rich people, when it comes to selling an asset, look at it the same way, but for a different reality. Why would I divest in this strategic asset that I wanted in the first place? The only answer is because I see potential for it to be devalued in the future instead of continuing to appreciate in value. And I see it as a risk asset now, and I want to off the risk asset. I want to risk off of it. Or there is a better asset that if I unclog this money, I can purchase that asset with. And it doesn't work to borrow from this asset to buy that asset for whatever reason. That's it. What rich people generally do is they build the asset portfolio massively. They factor in the average ROI of appreciation, and they borrow from that asset pile at a low enough loan to value ratio that they're always still growing the asset value, even using the loan to service its own debt. That's the formula for wealth. That makes no sense except in this system. And this is where I drop this on you. The way things are is way more important than the way you think they should be. There are so many people that it's wrong. And yeah, but it doesn't matter because it is. Well, it's all going to end someday. And I'm going to tell you this, not anytime soon. You have no, if you say that, you really haven't examined the systems of control here. And if it does end, it's all going to end in a flash, and it's going to hurt you no matter what you've done. And it won't end in a flash because all of the people that control the system are leveraging the system the way it was designed to be leveraged when it was built. So you're asking the pilot to intentionally crash the plane, not with a remote control from the ground, but from behind the stick. Well, he's probably not going to do that because he's going to go up in a ball of flames too. So it will stay as long as it can be made to stay. And what might look like a short period of time in the long lens of history is still a long time in a human individual lifetime. I would tell you, most of you with a little bit of gray in your beard like me or more, right? You're not going to live to see this system completely go away. It's not going to happen. So you might as well get with living with it. If you're really, really young, Maybe, but probably not. Most people alive today will die while there is still a fractional reserve economic system in place. I don't care if hyper-Bitcoinization happens. I don't care what happens. In fact, the more you move toward a portable system of monetary supply that really is inflation resilient, that really does hold value, the better this system works. I know that sounds crazy, but now I can hold my value in money and I can spend currency and I can arbitrage the differential, which is what rich people have always done, mostly with real estate or corporations. I have a company worth a certain amount of money so I can borrow against it, but the primary assets within the company that make it a good bet to lend against, unless we go into like corporate bonds or something like that, is the real estate inside the company. So the company's actually taking the loan and putting up the building as collateral. Do you get it? And, wow, thank you. Firebird Optics sent me $100 super chat. I hope I've given you that much value today. I really do, man. Thank you. That means a lot to me. I really appreciate that. He said, money printer go burr. Yeah. And the printer will go burr, but just remember what we said in the beginning. There is no actual printer anymore of any significant import. In other words, it doesn't matter how many $100 bills they print. It matters how many credits they create with keystrokes. That's the world you live in today. And I'm sorry I'm not giving you a bunch of solutions to it today, but that's not what today's about. Today I just wanted to revisit with you, because it's been a long time since we talked about this, where your money comes from, how it works, what printing money really means, why the debt can never be repaid, why every single person on TV, radio, et cetera, that says we need to pay off the debt or whatever is in denial of reality. We will not even significantly pay down the debt in your life. My biggest concern for all this is actually Social Security, because so many people depend on it, and we're really, like, we can see the finish line as to when we run out of money. We've been talking about it for decades, but it's like a marathon, like a 26-year instead of 26-mile marathon, and we're like, you know, 8 miles from the finish line now, and it's really flat downhill, and you can see the flag, right? And, yeah, that's where we're headed. Anyway, I only got a couple, one question in that super chat that I saw. If you have a question for me or something you want me to comment on as I wrap up here, go ahead and put it in the live chat now. Put either the word question or comment in all caps, and then I'll be more likely to see it. Again, that's for people watching the live, not people with the Memorex version. Ben Yoba says, Jack, but since the money to repay the interest was created initially, you will need to take money from somewhere else to pay back the interest. Therefore, sooner or later, someone will default. Not necessarily the case. Not necessarily the case. Now, people will default, but that's not why. People will default because they fail to earn enough money to pay it back. But this perpetual lending can go on indefinitely as long as the underlying system doesn't fail. And so when somebody fails to repay a mortgage, it's not because there wasn't enough money in circulation. It's because they didn't obtain enough money because they lost a job, because they poorly managed the income that they have. Now, what it does mean is you can't pay it all back. It's not about default. It's that sooner, and I guess if you tried it that way, if we made a concerted effort, everybody everywhere at every level was going to repay it, then Ben's prophecy would come to a head. Now, you would have to be well past the midpoint. So I don't know what I didn't check recently. What do we owe? 37, 38 trillion, 40 trillion, something like that. Let's say we owed 40 trillion, because if we don't, and I don't think we do yet, we will soon. And you paid it down to 20 trillion. You'd have a lot of consternation and problems and shrinkage of the monetary supply in that, but everything could still work. But as you cross that threshold and start to come, you'd actually then eventually come to a shortage of capital. And you would cause so much disruption, then you understand why they won't do it. Think of how many billionaires own real estate leveraged the way I explained. What happens if we have deflation of real estate? Their entire system of wealth creation and management collapses instantly. This is what Trump, he said the quiet part out loud earlier this year. if we let people build a lot more houses easily and inexpensively, we'll drop real estate prices, and that'll cost a lot of you a lot of money. A lot of you is all the people like him. And I don't even fault them for doing it. That's the incentives. Charlie Munger, if you want to understand why people do things in a system, examine the incentives. They'll always tell you why. That's what the incentive is there to do. But that is, right, what is the solution to all of this shortage of housing and the fact that people can't afford a house, that millennials can't afford a house? The millennials with good jobs that have worked hard and saved, they didn't piss all their money away. They're 34 years old, 36 years old, right? And they have, you know, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 put away. And they just look at the housing market, what a payment is, taxes, insurance, and everything. And they say, if I do this, I'm house poor. I'm not ready yet. And I don't know if I ever will be. Some of that is because their standard for what they think they have to have is a little higher than it needs to be for a starter home. But some of it's really legit. I won't deny that. But the solution to that would be drive the price of housing down. Housing has gone up more than makes sense. And that was your big inflationary pill that we all had to swallow from COVID and printing all that money. That's what it drove up. And as the price of housing drove up, the cost of lending came up with it as they, like it's inflation, let's raise interest rates, increase the cost of money. By increasing the cost of money, we slow the velocity of money to try to hold back inflation. That's what they did. Again, I'm not saying good, bad, indifferent. I'm saying that's what happened. Well, that drove the floor of entry into housing so high, people that weren't already in the game feel like they'll never get a toehold and get in. I think some of that's excuse making, and I think some of that is reality, especially depending on where you live. Okay, so let me ask you this, though. If we made it really simple and affordable and deregulated to the point where right now you know you can sell the shit out of houses, right? So if you're a builder, that's good. And we had a reasonable interest rate on a mortgage, 4%. And we made it really simple to build three-bedroom, two-bath style starter homes. And the average metro area like Dallas or Fort Worth or Atlanta or Jacksonville or whatever had a growth in available houses of 10,000 homes a year for the next 3 years. So a net 30,000 growth. What would happen to the price of housing? Don't you think it would come down? Well, those houses would be inexpensive. Yeah, but it would bring the whole market down into something approaching sanity again. And the reason it would do it is because since there's a place for those 30,000 people to go, when they go there, it becomes harder to sell that home that the paperwork says is worth 600 grand now, but it's probably worth like three, which is fine if you just live there. And you bought it long enough ago that your mortgage is less than that, you don't care. But if you have 10 of those houses and you're playing the leverage game in your retirement and that value of them all goes down, you can't get the rent for them anymore because those renters now have places they can go who are more economically balanced. And your bank goes, hey, asshole, your loan to value's off now. We're calling it all due. And everything implodes. So when I say this isn't going anywhere, there's your why. It's not going anywhere because we can't do it. It is untenable at this time. And the young people are like, I don't care. Fuck you. Just blow it up. You'd be screwed too. You'd be screwed too because the contraction of the economy would be so violent. The only way for this to happen is for it to be done slowly and intentionally and at an expert level across time. And there's no plan to do it and no will to do it. So everything will just keep getting worse until we reach a point where we kind of crash into a ceiling and we go into a more level period when it will all, at some point, it will all kick up again. That's your future. So adapt to it because it's not going to change. And your bullets, this is where I'll bring a few things in. They are precious metals. They are real estate. They are good quality, high level securities attached to operating entities that actually make a real profit doing a real thing. They are Bitcoin, right? They are not your shit coins. I don't care. I don't care that you think privacy is important. That is an opinion. It's an opinion I share, but it doesn't change the calculus here. There's only going to be one winner in that space. And so I've said my piece on that. I got three more things that came in. I'll hit them and we'll wrap up and be done. First, I've got tribal elitism. Question. In part two, we discuss use of force to demand trust in regard to money. No, not the way you're saying it. That doesn't make any sense. You want to restate that? I'll comment it on again. That there's missing connecting words in that sentence. Okay. Trapper7028 comment. Thanks. This is the first time I've heard about the money supply in this light. It's a little bit to digest. It's a lot to digest. Again, though, it's very simple. You promising to pay money creates money from an institution that can write up the paperwork that gives your promise credibility and tie it to a real asset that they can use as collateral if it's over a certain amount. Nothing I said is hard to understand, but it's difficult to accept because it's so preposterous in its nature. Imagine if you could think about the fact, think if anybody that wanted to could do this. Like, all you need is a counterparty willing to say yes, and they can write you a check without having any money. What if you went to your rich uncle and you said, Uncle Dale, Uncle Bill, whatever, I want to buy this house for $200,000. I don't like what the bank is offering for terms. Would you do it? And Uncle Bill says, yeah, I'll give you 2.5% interest on it. Why do I care? As long as you pay me back, I'm good. And you go, okay, but don't you need money? I mean, I'm not going to give you money. I'm going to give you a promissory note that you can use as money. See, at that point, that's where your brain goes, no, that doesn't make any sense. How can I go to Jack and ask Jack to loan me even $100 if Jack has $0? Or look at it this way. You want to borrow $100 from me. I have $1,000. I loan you $100 and I still have $1,000. Plus I have a receivable for another $100. So effectively now on my books, I have $1,100 of value plus interest across however long you're going to hold on to the money. I've expanded my monetary supply and your monetary supply, tendering you nothing but paperwork. And no, that doesn't, but when a bank does it, it makes perfect sense because they created a system that says you can do it. It's like a rule system in a computer program. It spits out a picture. The thing that it spit out isn't really there, but we all see the picture. That's where you're sitting at here. Right now, next one I have from Hey Hey Alabama. Is it worth buying property to rent for low income housing and let HUD cut you the check every month? The answer to that is a definite maybe, because every situation is different. If all the numbers work, why do you care who pays you? And in some instances, I would much rather have the government paying the majority of the rent than the individual, because as much as I hate the government, since they create the money out of thin air and they steal it from us, I'm going to get paid. Let's say I had a high-end house and I'm renting it for $3,000 a month to a person with a high income who loses their job and says, fuck it, it takes 60, 90 days to get me out of here. I'll just stay and not pay while I figure out what to do and run to another property next, and it takes me 3 months to get rid of them, and I'm eating the cost of that. If they are, you know, like a Section 8 renter or something, even if they don't pay, I still get the money from them. So I'm not saying it's bad. Now, your quality of tenant may not be great, et cetera, and your underlying property value is lower. But what I'll say about this is a common TikTok 18-year-old who claims to be worth $50 million. I rent all these houses and the government pays. Yeah, and bullshit. And if it was as easy as those people make it out, everybody would do it. So is it worth it? It might be. But if you want to go into the business of being a landlord, that is just one way that you might obtain and rent a property. And it shouldn't be seen as the way any more than anything else that you do. Like, it would be like saying, is it worth it to plant all California Wonder green peppers in my garden? How many California green Wonder peppers do you want? If you have some contract to sell them, yeah. Right? But you probably don't eat that many peppers. And if you have a big garden, you have a surplus of peppers, right? So there's an imbalance. It's not the same with a house. But if that house doesn't work for your economic model, you shouldn't do it, not because of what it is, but because it doesn't work for your model. I hope that makes sense. So as always, it depends. With that, what I want to do real quick here is let you know about the item of the day today. And of course, we are the Survival Podcast, and it is the show that helps you live a better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. Today's item of the day does exactly that. It is the Frigidaire portable ice maker. These sell for a little under $90, like $80-something. I think the stainless one is on sale today for like $86 or $87. Really good deal. Super simple product. You plug it in, you turn it on, and you say, I want big or small ice cubes. To be fair, I can't tell the difference between the two. They're the same to me. I leave it on large all the time. You put water in it. It goes in a reservoir. The water circulates up, and it trickles along some metal rods. These have the ability to freeze the water really fast. In my experience, it's about 8 minutes between cycles. So the first one will take a little longer, and then every 8 minutes you hear drop, drop, and it just keeps going. And when it runs low on water, you add water. That's how it works. Because of how it works, it's not a chamber using a compressor to make the entire chamber, let's say, 10 degrees Fahrenheit, like your freezer where you stick an ice cube tray in, and it takes all day to make one tray of ice cubes. Because you're cooling only the metal element and the ice is building in layers, you get very rapid freezing. And you get it for very little energy use. Translation, if you go out and buy something like an $800 power inverter and attach it to the battery of your vehicle and idle it every once in a while so you don't draw it down, you can make ice with your car. Now you got a prepper item. Now when your power's out, at least you can make ice, keep everything cold, fill up your coolers, and you can make ice for days and days and days if you have to. If you have a generator, even better, right? So it's great for that. But it also can just sit on a countertop and have ice there all the time for very low cost. You can free up space in your freezer because you're not using an ice maker and a tray in your freezer anymore if you choose to do that. If you have people coming over and you need extra ice, you have that available. You can even go buy bags that are made for holding ice on Amazon for pennies a piece, and over time fill up a freezer with bags of ice when you have a big event coming. So this is like parties, day-to-day use, and emergencies all in one for under $100. Pretty damn good deal. And Aaron's saying here, I spend $4 to $7 a week on ice in the summer. My tiny camper freezer takes a whole day to make ice. This is what you need, Aaron. This is what you need. And, you know, I'll tell you what would really benefit a lot of people if using this in Aaron's way, and this would not be for everybody. Go to Vivor, who I also have a link for at tspaz.com, and buy one of the small, inexpensive coolers that actually plug in. You can plug it into a vehicle. You can plug it into an AC outlet. Set it to a freezing temperature, make ice with this, and dump the ice into that. And then you have a complete kind of system. Now, this ice maker is making ice for that. Because the one thing I'll say about ice makers like this, the ice is kind of wet. You put it into a freezer, it kind of sticks together. So if you put it in bags, you can break it up. If you put it straight into a tray in your freezer, here's the hack. Dump it in, and about 15 minutes later, take like a knife sharpener or a rolling pin or a ice cream scoop or something and kind of smack it around and break it loose from each other. And do that every time you add some to it, and you'll end up without having a giant block of wet ice that all freezes together. But again, $80, these are a deal. I would get one while you can, while they're on sale again. And a note on that, yesterday I told you about something that was a really good deal. It was also about $80. It was a galvanized metal 4x8 foot garden bed. And by the time I was done with the show, The vendor had sold so many of them, they were down to only a couple left in inventory, so they jacked the price up to over $200. That's the T-Spaz effect. That's when you guys would only hear about it on the show. That's when I put it out on social media and everybody jumps on a deal like that. That's what happens. And I'm not going to say I'm the only one that did that because it was, you know, Amazon-wide sale, but generally speaking, that happens a lot when I put things out. So what does that mean? That means that if you were on the Telegram channel, right, if you were to do that, then you would always get information about it. Now, I'm not doing it for – I don't have the banner up right now where the Telegram channel is, but it's t.me/TSPC broadcast. If you subscribe to that on Telegram, when I put out an item of the day, you'll get a little text message on your phone or your device. When I'm about to do a live, you'll get a message. Hey, we're going to be doing a live today on this, this, and this. You'll get all that information. No one will filter it from getting to you. So if you're like, damn it, I missed a deal. That's the number one solution. Because the second I run that item for the day, I cut and paste a little alert I put across all social media, but it always goes in Telegram. And that is the number one way to make sure you don't miss any communications from me. Guys, thank you very much for being here with me today. I hope it helped you understand money a little bit differently. I hope it makes you a bit more immune to the bullshit stories that you're constantly told by people selling you things, by people pitching politics at you. The underlying problems that we deal with today are more a function of the monetary system itself than whoever happens to be in charge in D.C. at any given time. At least the economic portions of things. With that, take care. I'll catch you tomorrow. We have a great interview. I am bringing back Zach. I can't think of his last name now. But he's the guy behind the Stock Cropper. Automated chicken tractors and automated machinery that even moves like ruminants, like sheep or goats or even cattle or pigs in an automated fashion. He's made some big updates since the last time. Maybe it's Zach Smith. Is that right? I'm not sure. But Zach, he's coming back, the Stock Cropper guy, and we will have him tomorrow. You guys loved him a couple of years ago when I brought him around with his first generation of equipment. And I think what he has got for you tomorrow will blow you away. Take care, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow with that. They said you should have a house the American way. $1 down, $1 a month, and you never have to pay. Better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.